This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And today we're covering a subject from one of my favorite genres of things we've ever talked about on this show. And it's only the second subject from such sub-genre topic that we've done.
So you've got us spiraling down a hole here, Sam.
Already.
Where are we going?
Wow. That's a question. We're going all over the place. We're going as far back as the creation of all things, all the way to the modern day. We're going all over the place. And we're going to the Near East. We're going to Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic. We're going all over the place, man. Well, you can't hold me down. I'm all hopped up on orange vanilla Coke.
All right, then. So, in our travels, what are we experiencing?
Thank you for the segue. I don't know. This always happens every week. I'm like, how do we start talking about things?
I try my best.
You do everyone. Really quite well. Sometimes I intentionally mess this up.
Yeah.
Like now.
So, on today's episode,
We're going to be talking about one of the most unique and interesting legends of all time, and that is the Golem.
But is it that unique?
Oh, it's super unique. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it is one of the only truly non-pagan, unique folklore mythologies. Not one of the only, but one of the few. I mean, typically, when we look at the paranormal, the supernatural, and we look at folklore and mythology and stuff like that, we're almost always drawing, either consciously or subconsciously, from the pagans, from polytheistic monsters and gods and creatures and this and that.
Yeah, the fun stuff.
Yeah, the good stuff. The great stuff. I love it. But what's interesting about the Golem, as I hope we will see, is that it exists in a different world than that. And so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about
that. You say that, but I also feel like the Golem itself also personifies a very classic storytelling entity in general. Like, it's a very classic trope. And I think that a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about kind of personifies, well, what we're going to be getting into a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, this is why we have a podcast where we talk to each other. Instead of just me talking to people and you talking to people.
Got a lot of hand movement
So that
today.
We can have a dialogue, a conversation about all of this. So, if you're all right with it, I say we dive in.
Let's get going.
It's probably going to be a little bit of a long one.
Because
we'll see.
From my understanding, we're going to have to dig up a lot of material. Clay.
Because it's clay? That's a terrible, terrible joke. But I will give you, I'll mark it down, and I'll make sure you get your bonus for that. So thank
Perfect.
You. If people don't know, Jason gets paid by the joke. The other thing that we're going to cover, though, or in conjunction with this, is this bigger idea, this greater idea of Jewish mysticism, which is one of my favorite subjects. And that's why this is going to be a little bit longer, because I really want to make sure we have the proper setting and the proper context for what's going on. So without further ado, thank you, but that was technically some ado.
Yeah.
So please stop.
I'm a don't.
Oh, no. Yes. So we are going to talk about something, this Golem, which, I mean, it comes up in so many different ways in pop culture. I think I probably ran across it for the first time when I was very young and I was like looking up Pokemon. And guess what? There's a Pokemon called
Boulder Man.
yes, Boulder Boy. The Pokemon Golem. And then later on in my life, I was watching the first season of Sherlock. And in that, there was this mysterious shadowy contract killer who went by the name of the Golem. And then, a little later on, even though it technically came out before the first season of Sherlock, I didn't see it until afterwards, and then I watched one of the best movies I've ever seen, Inglourious Basterds, by Quentin Tarantino. And in that, you have Hitler claiming that the terrified soldiers who are being picked off and hunted down by the bastards, that they are worried that one of them is a golem, and he's come to protect the Jewish people from against them. So to me, it's really fascinating how this same concept can manifest in so many different ways.
I think it definitely has gotten a breath of new life from the 20th century onward. There are quite a few different movies from the early 1920s, there's actually from 1920, yeah. There was a German film titled The Golem.
Yeah.
And then we've seen tiny little dashes of it throughout the 20th century, and now we're actually kind of getting almost a golem renaissance in the 21st century now.
Because all right.
We're starting to take this same kind of archetypal creature, and we're applying it to different things and different... Yeah. And it's kind of, yeah, getting a breath of new life through it, which all is really right. fun.
The Golem Renaissance.
Because...
I think that's going to be my band name.
One of my favorite... video games, Dragon Age Origin, which is made by BioWare before they got bad. Yeah, they're having a rough time. But there is golems in there that were created by the Dwarf Society, and they were very, well, typical to a Jewish golem in a lot of ways, to where they're very simple. And then, let's see, there's a recent show made by Netflix that I just watched because I binge watch everything.
Why not?
Named by The Order. Not great. You can pretty much predict everything that's going to happen way before it happens, but their golem is named Clay, so spoiler alert, I guess.
That's not even worth a spoiler alert.
I know, but the way that the golem's created is actually pretty similar to how the historical golem is created as well, with having actually etched words onto the forehead of the creature, which is kind of cool. So
nice.
It is a little bit more of a literal interpretation of the old way of bringing about a golem, which
yeah.
I'm sure you're going to dive
oh,
into
yeah.
here.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into all of it. We're going to get into all of it. But the question is, at the very center, what is a golem? Now, the other question is, how do you pronounce golem? And as far as I can tell, the right way to pronounce it is
Golem.
No,
no,
that's
no.
terrible. I do appreciate you moving back from the mic. Is Golem. So Golem, not Golem, not Golem, Golem. So
I'm gonna
mispronounce so many things. So it's fine. But the Golem, just as the bare bones of what it is. You kind of referenced it in talking about that movie or that TV show. The golem is a creature that is shaped out of clay and animated to serve its creator. So that's it. I mean, it's very interesting because the golem starts and as it adapts throughout the ages, we see it fill a lot of roles. Like, for instance, what we now think about in like iRobot, right? In iRobot, we made these things just to serve us. And that was pretty much the idea of the golem through folklore. And you see this happen all throughout the time of the golem. It changes throughout the generations and just becomes more understandable as different things. It's even nowadays kind of compared to things like AI, not even like general AI in the future, but like AI now, where you have like these programs and these things that are running, and of course they're not conscious, but they're doing things, you know, and they're only doing what their creators say. So that is the very bare bones of what the golem is.
So they're beasts of burden.
They're beasts really. Of burden, exactly. They're as simple of a being as you can make that is still able to do something.
I think though through and I'm sure you're going to cover a few of these stories, but what I've noticed going through a few of them myself is that these golems tend to almost be like another personality in some ways, where they can take on a life that I wouldn't necessarily be able to support myself. There's one that's kind of a protector in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. where if I'm a feeble body person, like that's just not something that I can do, but if I create this thing that does it for me, mm-hmm. This sort of piece of myself in a way, then then maybe like it's kind of that weird trope. And also I've noticed quite a bit that it's sometimes you get more than what you expect out of things.
Yeah.
And there's a lesson in kind of wanting to get all this extra stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that'll become, again, exemplified. I know I'm being very around the point at this point
in time, all right.
But I don't want to give anything too much away.
Too much away. Well, and you know what? I really like the example you used of I'm a weak person. I create or I employ a golem to protect me because I can't do it myself. And what's really interesting is that while the golem begins as just a simple beast of burden, as we'll talk about, it becomes a ceremonial and symbolic defender of the Jewish people living in the diaspora as they've been dispersed throughout the world, left their homelands, and pop up all throughout mainland Europe.
Which I'm extremely ignorant, but how does the Jewish faith and culture really deal with violence? Are we trying to be as pacifist as possible, or
especially, yeah. So you have like throughout Old Testament times where you have a lot of stories and legends and wonderful portraits of Israel and the Jewish people as a mighty conquering nation. However, even then, the conquering, the violence, it all has to be done according to a very specific set of rules. And usually
it has a code to it.
Yeah, usually it only comes at the command of the higher power. Throughout the diaspora, as the Jews are just living as little isolated pockets and ghettos throughout the world, they are an exceedingly non-violent culture. So violence is definitely not something that they ascribe to, as well. Actually, we'll get into that.
Okay, so it's not like the golem is the loophole around from me committing some sort of sin.
No, because even then, the golem does not work as a warrior attacking. He only works as a defender.
Right.
So he's only there to stop anything coming, and that's a sophistication that grows with this legend as it grows. But when we look at that, we have to start and say, where did the idea of the golem come from, and where did it actually start? And so with that, the earliest use of the word golem comes from the Tanakh, which is also, we know it as the Hebrew Bible, or Christians refer to it as the Old Testament. Now, the word golem is interesting, and just get ready for a lot of mispronunciations. The word golem is interesting because it is what is referred to as a hapax legomenon.
Come again? I'm kidding. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's what that was. So that means it's a word that only occurs once in either a specific written record, a specific context, or in some cases, throughout the entirety of a particular language. There's only one account of this word happening. With the golem in the Tanakh, it's only one case in that setting. It is used later in different documents and stuff like that. But with biblical translation, especially into English and all translation is into other languages, which is what I was about to say, like an idiot. Especially with translation, so much of this relies on context clues. I mean, especially with ancient Hebrew, one word can and does mean dozens and dozens of things throughout the old records. So for there to only be one instance of this word, it can create quite a confusion about what it means. Now, the hapax legomenon, it's not an uncommon phenomenon. It happens about 1,500 times over the course of the Old Testament. And what you see is things being translated differently and theoretically, you know, well, maybe it means this, maybe it means that.
Interpretation.
Yeah. And that comes out really well as we look at modern translations of the point where the word golem is used in the Old Testament, which is in the 139th Psalm in verse 16. So its typical translation is this verse is, "Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book was written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them." Now, the word in that is golem is translated as unformed substance. Your eyes saw my golem, or my unformed substance. Now, in some other translations, though, like for instance, the old KJV, King James Version, that is translated as your eyes saw my substance yet being unperfect, an unperfected substance. The New King James Version says, my substance being yet unformed. The New International Version, which is a very common translation, says, my unformed body. The Common English Bible translates it as embryo. And translations that tend more towards the paraphrase render it as a concept that has to do with the author, traditionally King David, trying to convey the idea that God knew him before he, David, existed. That's the bare meaning of this word.
Mm-hmm.
However, what we see is that it gets further developed in what's known as the Talmud. Now, the Talmud makes up probably the most substantial portion of the religious and legal codes of the Jewish people. By the way, I love this stuff. I'm a giant nerd for it.
Okay.
So.
It's all you, buddy.
If you don't like it, take a nap. That's fine. We'll be through all of this in just a little bit.
I've been drinking coffee,
so. There we go. The Talmud makes up a substantial portion of the religious and legal codes of the Jewish people after the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, which took place in 70 AD. After this, Judaism transitions from what's known as the Second Temple period to the Rabbinical period. This is when, instead of having either in your first temple period, you had direct revelation from God in the temple. In the Second Temple period, you mainly had interpretations of the texts of the First Temple period. You had a lot of commentaries and a lot of trying to make sense of it. In the Rabbinical period, it's even further commentary about that, but it's more of saying, okay, we're out of our homeland, we're out amongst the nations, how do we stay Jewish? How do we stay who we are? And so with the Rabbinical period, you see the actual establishment, not establishment, but the practice of actual rabbis, people who were supposed to lead entire groups of people throughout their lives.
At this point, then, there is a Jewish network, then.
Yes.
Was there a centralized synagogue of some sort? Like a centralized power for the Jewish faith?
Not necessarily. And that's why the rabbinical...
It was mostly just small community-esque stuff?
Okay. Exactly. So back in the First and Second Temple periods, other than during the Babylonian exile and stuff... basically, if you had a question, you would appeal to your local higher up who would keep appealing up the chain. That chain ends at the temple in Jerusalem where they'd make an inquiry or they'd try to speak directly to God. Here, you make an inquiry and it goes up to your local rabbi and he's pretty much the be-all end-all because you don't have that higher power structure.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's another really interesting reason as to why the idea of the ghetto really formed, right? The ghetto being the poor parts of the cities that Jews lived in, their Jewish quarters. And the ghetto would form because, according to the Talmud and other law, there's only a certain amount of steps you could take on the Sabbath day, which means that your people had to be very close to the synagogue. The synagogue was the fundamental and primary center of Jewish life in the diaspora, and it's why so often we see them Jews congealing into certain areas during that time, as opposed to just spreading throughout, you know, civilization. So,
in neighborhoods, then, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Clearly,
so the Talmud, it is the basis of Jewish daily life. It most likely came into its existence in its present written down form at the latest around 700 AD. However, it most likely began even before the end and the destruction of the Second Temple, going throughout hundreds of years. In its current form, the Talmud is 6,200 pages long. So there's that.
Oh, God.
There's a lot.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
There's a lot.
Now, there are definitely points in the Talmud, a few, where the word golem is meant to mean man, and especially a man that is keeping with the idea of unformed or unfinished. So you'd see people, commentaries come out talking about the golem and the traits of the golem, which would be to be quick to anger and be quick to speak and slow to understand. That was the idea of the golem as a man.
Right.
However, there are ample examples of the word also being used specifically for what we would think of as supernatural examples. Now, in the Talmud, specifically, it's broken into what are called tractates. So specifically in the tractate Sanhedrin, in the chapter 38b, there's a verse that is interpreted under the lenses relating to Adam, of Adam and Eve fame. And the word golem is used here and translated to refer to Adam as he is formed out of the clay and stood up by God, but before he gets any sort of independent spirit. And that's really where this idea of the golem as a clay creature comes in, an unfinished man. And so, of course, the word Adam, or Adam, means mankind, and it comes out of the other Hebrew word Adamah, which means the earth. So you just see this connection that all the way back, mankind is very connected to the actual dust of the ground, and the only thing that separates us from the dust of the ground is a very important point wherein God breathes the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam in order to, as it says, make him a living creature or a living soul. This concept is expanded on in the Talmud in order to paint the word golem not as a potential life in the natural means of creation, i.e. an embryo in the womb or the unfinished substance of King David in the womb, but rather as a supernatural means of creation, literally bringing life up out of the dirt or out of the clay. It's more than worth noting that this is a mythological motif that runs throughout folklore and culture across the width and breadth of the world. I mean, you not only have your Near Eastern cultures like the Greeks, the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Egyptians, but you also have your more Far East like the Chinese, you have Hinduism, Islamic, Maori, Incan, even First Nations of North America, who all develop this motif in some way or the other of mankind being shaped up out of the ground. And it just seems something innate to say that we've always understood that, like, this ground that we're on is so central to who we are and to our own existence that we have to share some part of ourselves with it.
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense, too, because we can all observe death.
Yeah.
We can observe decay, which in that part, we do return to the earth. So it just makes sense for the circle to be completed with us rising from it.
Coming up out. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Because a lot of early religion and early culture is all about the circle of completion of life and earth and how we just live through cycles.
Yeah, totally.
So it makes a lot of sense to say, oh, if
he went into
we return
the earth.
It to the earth at death, we must rise from the earth at birth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild, isn't it?
It's cool.
Mythology. I love the portrait it paints of man's psyche that way.
I think it does give you a different insight than what we normally experience. And I think through time, we've kind of lost that connection to how we viewed the world in the past.
I know. And I think a big part of it, to wax philosophical here, is that especially in our post-Enlightenment era, we see things as either completely literally true or not true. And if they're not literally true, then they don't have any truth and they're without meaning and they're valueless. But to look at mythology is to say that most likely none of this is literally true, except for maybe some portions here and portions there. And yet these are the stories that we've been telling since we could tell stories. And so there has to be something spiritually true about them, you know? And I don't know, man.
Well, most of them are lessons in learning and in a way to try to make sense of the world around us.
And try to make sense of ourselves, though.
Right.
You know, it's wild.
Especially since the Enlightenment, that we have definitely done as much as we can to disassociate ourselves with the natural world as well. So I think, you know, at some point in time, we should kind of recollect ourselves and really understand how connected we are to everything around us, not just the houses that we build and the technology that we surround ourselves with.
Well, and I mean, you see it. You see it throughout the artistic movements. You see the Dark Ages leading to the Renaissance. You see throughout the Renaissance, we start heading towards the Enlightenment.
Yeah, there's always there's always that revolt. Yeah. There's always that, no, I don't want to go with the flow. I want to go back to what it was before.
Exactly. Just like after the, I think I'm right in saying this, my periods might be a little mixed up either one way or the other, but after the Enlightenment, you have the Romantic period.
Correct.
You have this idea of like, oh, there is something more beautiful and true deep at our very core. And then we move through that into now, which I really think is an age of, it's very exemplified through like the New Age movement and the resurgence of like neo pagan practices, where maybe you're not literally like praying to Thor because you don't believe in literally Thor up in the sky, but you do understand that there is like something greater,
something happening up there. How globally connected we tend to lose a part of our identity. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, like researching and kind of diving back to where our ancestors came from gives us a little bit more of a sense of self and understanding and where we come from.
Yeah.
And I think that's always important.
Yeah. Well, and I just think it's cool to be able to say like, I'm part of a tradition. I'm part of a tradition that's been telling these stories since the dawn of time, you know?
Right.
And,
like, everyone is technically a success story.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Thousands, hundreds of thousands of years.
Let that be your motivation for the day from Jason. All of you are success stories. You wouldn't be here if not. That's awesome.
You come from a long line of people getting very lucky or incredibly skilled.
One
of the two. Probably a little bit of both.
Probably a little of both. Takes a little luck. Anyway, thank you for that philosophical discussion. Back to the Talmud.
Lightning.
So in the Talmud, it states, right, that Adam is formed out of the dust of the ground. It says that he only lived for 12 hours, or he only existed for 12 hours before his expulsion from the Garden of Eden. 6 hours in is when he has stood up and life is breathed onto him. And then he has 6 more hours. He royally screws it and he leaves. And at that point,
that makes
sense. He's technically a golem, or he's technically not a golem after hour 6, when he gets the breath of life in him and he's doing his own thing and he's got free will. But you really get this idea through the Talmudic literature that it wasn't until after he left the garden that he was actually a full-blown human being and had transitioned out of that golem kind of state. So, and maybe it's because in order to be something that does not exist only to obey its maker, it has to disobey its maker first. So, now, another theme that this develops, though, is this disgust of certain groups of angels towards mankind. So you have this first group that comes in and says, look at this golem, look at this dirty thing that you made, I hate it. And God just burns them up, just sets them on fire. Now, after this, you have a second group of angels come, and they say the same thing, hey, look at this, I hate it. And God just burns them up too. And then finally, you have a third group that says, you know what, if you make it, I love it. It's great. It's made out of dirt, but who cares?
As they stand right next to the burnt the corpses burnt up of angels. Previous angels. You're like, no, sir, this is great. This is great. You take criticism well.
This is perfect. Thank you. So now, further on in the Talmud, though, we see something happen that really sets the tone for golem legends going forward. And what it is that there's this story, it's further on in the Sanhedrin tractate, of these two individuals named Rav Hananiah and Rav Hoshaiah. And Rav just means spiritual teaching or respected individual. Now, they're studying from this thing called the Halakot of Creation, which means the book or the law of creation, every Sabbath. And then they'll use what they learned to create a calf, a baby cow, that every Sabbath they would slaughter and use as their Sabbath meal. Now, the text makes note that this practice had been permitted ad initia, or from the beginning, meaning most likely from the beginning of time. This presents a very interesting portrait because it juxtaposes in the text, as it were, between a call for genuine witchcraft to be met with the punishment of death, or at the very least exile and being put out of the society. However, later on, you have this story of the two Ravs creating this being. And so it's like, well, is that not witchcraft? Is that not magic? And Israel, Judaism in general, has a very complicated relationship, or actually it's a very straightforward relationship with witchcraft, which is don't do it.
So with that in mind, is this okay because can Ravs be women?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Because is it really the, again, kind of where we've seen a lot of patriarchal societies?
No, this is even men practicing magic were put to death just as quickly as women.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what makes this magic acceptable? Is it, or is it still somewhat like a taboo?
That's the question.
Because we're not just like medicine doctors or people that practice medical healings of some sort, because that's basically what healers and people that practice witchcraft kind of were in the very, very early stages in the beginning. It wasn't really malicious.
Yeah.
Is that the weird connotation that gets like thrown off there?
That's the juxtaposition, right? Is, again, the witchcraft is not
hypocritical,
acceptable, but typically when you see witchcraft being used and being punished, what you see is a appeal to dark forces to do dark things. The only reason why it seems that this kind of magic was permitted is that it was done in piety. It wasn't seen as magic. It was seen as tapping into a gift. And according to a man named J.H. Chahes, he's writing for a Tablet magazine, which is a contemporary Jewish publication. He says that in Jewish culture, magic has both been seen as, quote, the most profound degradation of the spirit and, quote, the highest actualization of human potential. And so when you're looking at this story, you see it cast in that light. This is the highest actualization of human potential. These people who were made by God to help rule the world with God are tapping into these sorts of powers that typically are only available to God. And yet, because they are pure of heart, they're good. You know, they're okay to do it. So it's not cut and dry. And honestly, these sorts of practices, or even Kabbalah to this day, is still not totally understood and not totally accepted worldwide.
So it is still taboo.
It is still slightly taboo, yeah. It's not going to get you killed or get you exiled as long as you're doing it already.
But it's not something that you talk about with polite company.
Exactly. Now, in the Sanhedrin tractate, there is another reference that talks about an individual named Rava, who was a highly renowned rabbi living around the 3rd century. He constructed a golem. This is the first point where we see an actual man of clay being made by a man. He constructs the golem, he sends it to another rabbi whose name is Zira, and Rabbi Zira speaks to it and says, "Return to the dust," and it does so. This statement is followed with another that says, for the righteous, they could even create a world if they desired. So you again see this linking of, if you're doing it for the right reasons, you'll be permitted to do it and it's okay to do.
But you're almost not transcending to godhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're only going to be able to do that if you're getting your power from the right place, is the idea, especially in these older texts.
Now, is that because these older texts still recognize the old gods? They just cast them in the evil light?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you look at the Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible, it is gods fighting gods. And like, it's not always received that way and cast that way, but there are multiple points where it talks about the God of Israel fighting the gods of Egypt and like subjugating them. Now, the idea, the higher idea, is that there is one God who created everything, including these other gods. And so they are under his authority, but just like mankind has the ability to make their own terrible decisions and mess everything up, so too have these other created beings been given that free will. And if they use it wrong, they'll just be destroyed at the end of the day. So this is another source of power, though, that you could maybe tap into, is the gods of Egypt. I mean, you see it especially in the Hebrew text of Exodus, wherein Pharaoh's magicians are doing magic and making impossible things happen because they're calling on these evil forces. Whereas Moses is doing it, and what we would call his miracles were really magic in that society at that time.
Right.
But
right.
It's about the source.
It depends on which god you're claiming from your perspective.
Yeah, exactly. As humanity emerged out of the Middle Ages, the idea of certain magical practices being not only permissible, but rather entirely the purview and the right of all law-abiding human beings really begins to take hold. And right about the time that the rest of Europe is interested in and obsessed with alchemy and trying to create the philosopher's stone and things like that, this is where Kabbalah really starts to take off, and the creation of golems happens more frequently in folklore. It's not just a one-off here or a one-off there. Because
when you think about it, it is just straight up alchemy. In a lot of ways. Yeah.
It completely and totally is. Instead of being something that is referenced obliquely in commentaries and holy books, sages of that period become more and more convinced that, as the Talmud states, if they were righteous, they too could create a golem. However, they lacked the key. They lacked the ability to do so. But around the time of the rise of Kabbalah, you also have the Sefer Yetzirah, which is the book of creation that the Ravs Hananiah and Hoshaya were studying from all those years ago. Like I said, it's mentioned in the Talmud, but we don't know where it comes from, when it comes from, and if what we have now is the same thing that they were reading from in the 400 AD. However, tradition states that its origin is all the way back to the patriarch Abraham. Regardless of where or when this book comes into being, it is regarded as a classic text not only of Kabbalah, but especially of creation magic within Kabbalah. It's a book about how the world was created, and I can't explain it because I don't understand it. So what I'm just going to do is just read a part of it to you, and I want you to know, you to tell me how much of this we get. So... all right. This is one of the most important teachings of the Sefer, which are the 10 emanations of reality. All right. Quote, "These are the 10 emanations of number. First is the spirit of the living God, blessed and more than blessed be the name of the living God of ages. The Holy Spirit is his voice, his spirit, and his word. Second, from the spirit he made air and formed for speech 22 letters. Three are mothers, seven are double, and 12 are simple. But the spirit is first among these, third primitive water. He also formed and designed from his spirit and from the void and formless made earth, even as a rampart or standing wall, and varied its surface even as the crossing of beams. Fourth, from the water he designed fire, and from it formed for himself a throne of honor with alphanim, seraphim, holy animals and ministering angels, and with these he formed his dwelling, as it was written in the text, quote, who maketh his angels spirits and his ministers a flaming fire, unquote, and then unquote again to break. That I can track, right? To start, we have the spirit, and then the spirit creates the air, and then out of the air come these 22 letters, so that's a little bit of a thing. But from the letters come the water, and then the water come the fire, right? That, all right.
So what it kind of sounds like to me is a creation of the spirit,
uh-huh,
the world,
uh-huh,
and civilization.
Okay. Okay.
Because fire is the quintessential reason why civilization rose.
Uh-huh.
That in with language.
Okay.
Language is the reason why civilization continued. It is essentially, these are the bits and pieces that are required, really, for how humanity sees themselves as humans, sentient creatures, and separates itself from the animal kingdom.
All right. So that's the first four emanations.
Ah, shoot.
The rest of them. Quote, he selected three letters from the simple ones and sealed them as forming his great name. And here, these are just letters of the Hebrew alphabet that I don't know how to pronounce. So I am really sorry if you speak Hebrew. I apologize. Forming his great name, Yud Hai Wa. And he sealed the universe in six directions. Fifth, he looked above and sealed the height with Yud He Hua. Sixth, he looked below and sealed the deep with Yud Wa He. Seventh, he looked forward and sealed the east with He Yud Wa. Eighth, he looked backwards and sealed the west with He Wa Yud. Ninth, he looked to the right and sealed the south with Wa Yud He. Tenth, he looked to the left and sealed the north with Wa He Yud. Unquote. So that's where I get lost. I understand this idea of like sealing, but even then I don't understand what we're sealing or why and how these letters are doing it.
It sounds like he's, again, like almost creating the world and how it moves.
Oh, okay.
Looking forward to the east, where the sun rises, west,
okay.
Where it ends.
You got the that kind of thing. Mystic.
Do you get where I'm coming from with that? That it seems like he is creating the realm in which things exist.
Yeah. Well, and it's important to...
establishing a natural order of some sort.
Yeah. So it's important to remember that in Hebrew, the name of God is three letters, and it's the ones that he mentions here, Yod, He, and Wah, which then, because ancient Hebrew didn't have vowels, you basically inserted the vowels, yeah, based on pointing... And so that is often translated as Yahweh, but the same three letters that make that name are just put together in different combinations all throughout the rest of these emanations to seal reality. So there's that, man. It's dope. I kind of get where you're coming from, and I think you're on the right track, but I still don't understand exactly like what that means or why or how, or it's awesome. I'm going to spend a very long time of my life understanding all of this.
Let me know what you come up with.
I will. So to the individuals who are able to understand these mystical writings, theoretically, the promises of all the powers of creation lay at their fingertips. The entirety of the book, which is five chapters long, is structured as an examination of language as an act of creation, which is very on brand for the God of Israel, who is described as simply speaking things into reality, more effortlessly than some of his nearby adversaries who created the world either by self-sacrifice or through great powers with monsters and chaos
is
and all
that. Is
that
why magic, you have to speak the spells?
Probably.
Is that, do you think that has some sort of root in that kind of mysticism?
It very well could be. I think it's a common idea. I think that the Hebrews, in my opinion, their mythology is the one that's based the most on that idea. But this idea that words do have power.
You speak it into the world.
Yeah, that's the most reality that you can affect is through your act of speech. And as we'll see here in a moment, it goes even further. Like it gets very intense with the Jewish mysticism and the words and the acts of speaking. This power of creation through speech is something that the mystics believed could be accessible to them as well. And believe it or not, everyone listening to this may have already kind of known or imitated in their own way. What I'm about to say is complete conjecture. There's not a lot of evidence against it, but there's also not a lot of evidence for it. But what you see, okay, Hebrew is not the only language that has been spoken by the Jewish people throughout time. In fact, it was supplanted as the primary language of communication during the time of the Babylonian exile and throughout the diaspora. For example, there's this other language, the one that supplanted it, called Aramaic. The entire book of Daniel, which is one of the latest books of the Old Testament, is written in Aramaic. Jesus spoke Aramaic throughout the Gospels. It's this language that is the primary language of the Talmud and other rabbinical writings. Now, Aramaic is in the same language group as Hebrew, which is Semitic, and the two are similar in many ways, just like how Romance languages are in the modern world. But that's all true. The part that may or may not be true is a very interesting connection between Aramaic speech and magic. In Aramaic, there is a phrase pronounced Avra Kadabra.
No.
Which means, I create as I speak.
Okay. So, nail on the hammer?
It could be that this is... It's one of two things. Either this is a origin for what we know now, the magic words of abracadabra, or the magic words of abracadabra came from a further back source, or that after the fact, because this happens with linguistics, after the fact, people are like, oh, abracadabra, that sounds kind of like avracadabra. Okay, so it's Aramaic. So we don't know for sure, but to me, I'm rolling with that. I think that's dope, that this is ancient Aramaic for I will create as I speak, and that is why it is a magic word. Which, the story of abracadabra could be its own frickin' bonus episode. There's a lot to that. But anyway, I just thought that was
interesting. But it sounds like it does lay the groundwork for the Western idea of magic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that everything that we have in the West comes from, especially the Near East. The Far East has, as far as I understand it, more of a kind of emphasis placed on more material magic, certain materials being combined and being used for this purpose and that purpose. Whereas in the Near East, you have more of this idea of just speaking and things happening, which can also be in conjunction as well. I think we had talked about doing an entire series on the different kinds of magic, and who knows? We might be getting there. We might have to do that soon.
There'd be a lot.
There'd be a lot, but...
We might just have to make it, like, bits and pieces.
Fair. Therefore, though, when we look at the creation of the golem by Kabbalists in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, it should be no surprise that the primary way of bringing a golem to life was through the use of words and letters. Now, there are a number of different traditions surrounding this practice, all of them including in some way letters and speaking. Now, the first method was to recite letter combinations made out of the first half of the Hebrew alphabet to create the golem. And then to destroy him, you spoke words made out of the letter combinations of the second half. Now, this is an idea that comes from an older idea and a fundamental idea in the Sefer Yetzirah, which is that of the 231 gates. Now, these are the 231 steps through which creation passed in its culmination to its final and perfected form before humans showed up and ruined it.
That makes sense. I was going to say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not perfect now. Now, each of the gates is a representation of each singular letter's connection to each other letter. So basically, what you have is the idea of reality building as each layer goes through and connects to every other layer. So, for instance, when we're looking at the Hebrew alphabet, what we would do is go ahead. Where is it? I've got it here. What we would do to create the golem, I'm not going to go through all of them, but you would go through the first half of the gates, which are all of the letters spoken forward, and then you'd go through all of them spoken backwards. So you would, for instance, go Aleph Bet, Aleph Gamal, Aleph Dalet, Aleph He, Aleph Vav, Aleph Zion, Aleph Chet, Aleph Tet, Aleph Yad, Aleph Kav, Aleph Lamed, Aleph Mem, Aleph Nun, Aleph Samek, Aleph Ayan, Aleph Pe, Aleph Zadi, Aleph Kof, Aleph Resh, Aleph Shin, Aleph Tov. That's one of the... So that's from the very first letter to the very first, or the very last.
Is that one gate?
No, that would be, how many? 23 or 21 of the gates.
There. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So you do all of them one way, and you don't repeat. So when you get to bet, which is the second word, you don't go bet, aleph, bet, gamal. Because you've already done aleph, bet, you do not do bet, aleph. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you're only saying each combination once, and then you would go the other way to decreate the golem.
Okay.
So it's a lot of start words. At the back. Yeah, it is. And it takes about, I want to say, somebody did the math. God bless them. It takes about 30 minutes of complete unbroken concentration and speaking to do this. And of course, if you stutter, if your cadence is off, there's of course timing that goes into this. If any of that's messed up, you just have to start again.
That sounds horrible if you're trying to quickly stop a golem.
That is true. It is not a super effective system. But this relationship between the pairs of letters in the Hebrew alphabet, it served not only in golem creation, but for all the mystics, basically a method of meditating upon creation to better understand it and the creator. Now, another method, which is more time effective for sure, and also more of a popular way of doing it, would be to form the golem, the body, and then to write across its forehead a word. Okay, so the first word that you would write is Emet, which is three letters, and this means truth. Now, when the time came and the golem needed to be deanimated, you would simply erase the first letter, which would leave the word met, which means he is dead. And at that point, the golem would revert back to lifeless clay. Finally, the last step to create...
That seems much simpler.
It is very much simpler. The last step to create a golem, or last way, would be to shape the golem and to give it an open mouth. And then you would take and write the Tetragrammaton, which is the three-letter name of God. It's translated as YHWH. You would take that, write it out, and place it in the mouth, and then close the mouth. This would animate the golem until such a time as the paper was removed and the golem would turn back into lifeless clay. However, once the golem was created, it wasn't always as simple as that. You kind of mentioned it. So many of these stories, they get into the golem increasing in its complexity and increasing in its intelligence and increasing in its will to live. I think, like everybody, once you've been alive, you kind of get used to it and you kind of don't want to stop that. And the golem is no exception. Now, when you look at your very earliest golem stories that are not found in the Talmud, that are not just one lines here or there, what you almost always see is a reoccurring motif, which is there is a man, a very wise rabbi, who does not want to do all of the work or cannot do all of the work that he needs to survive. So the wise rabbi creates a golem. Now, integral to Jewish thought is the idea of the Sabbath. So every 7 days, you just don't do, well, you don't do anything, but you rest. You don't work. You don't create. You don't destroy. You only have set amounts of steps you can walk, things like that. So in order to make sure that the golem, which was alive in its own way, does not violate the Sabbath, you have to deactivate it every Friday afternoon, and then you can reactivate it Saturday night after the first stars dawn in the sky or first stars illuminate the sky, and you're going to be fine. Now, the golem will go around, and day by day, and especially iteration by iteration as it's destroyed and created, it gets bigger and it gets stronger. The golem will chop wood, carry water, do whatever you need it to do. Eventually, there is going to be a day when the rabbi forgets to deactivate the golem for a Sabbath. The golem understands that this is unjust somehow, is very upset, and begins a rampage. Typically, all that happens is they just mark off the letter on the head, or they take the scroll out of the mouth. It can also be in the arm that has the name of God, and the golem deactivates. Sometimes, because the golem has gotten so large,
it's hard to do that.
You can't do that. Can't reach it. Yeah. So what you do is you trick the golem into bending over. In almost all of these legends where you have to trick the golem into bending over, and usually, typically, it's like, oh, he's starting to turn. I don't have... It's already the Sabbath. He's going to go crazy. I know how this goes. Golem, tie my shoe for me. The golem bends over to tie the shoe. He quickly wipes away the first letter. The golem then collapses forward and crushes the rabbi who made him. That is a typical golem story. And that is how, not only how they were perceived before the event we're going to talk about here in a moment, but also how they were perceived very much after. There, Jason says we're in a golem renaissance now, which very much may be true, but the very first golem renaissance took place in the 1800s, as we'll talk about. And those are the kinds of stories that we see coming out of traditional golem ideas. It's not until the mid-1800s, then projected backwards in time, that we see a more complex story come out, and really the story that we're familiar with, okay? So, the important thing to remember is that as we talk about this folklore, for some people it does. It transcends the realm of theory and mystical belief. For some, including Jewish people, the golem is just a bedtime story, obviously. That's how I would think of it. I'm sure that's how Jason thinks of it. It's a story you tell your kids. It's a folk tale. You know, it's not
for
real.
Me, it's akin to Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, I'm glad it you is, brought that up.
It's a creation of simple matter into something that is semi-sentient, and then the consequences of making this, even if it was for simple intentions or pure intentions, and then ultimately there's the climax of destroying your creation.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's gotten out of hand in some way.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a story. It's not true.
Correct.
Unless...
Nope.
Well, again, it's maybe it didn't happen. That doesn't mean it's not true, though. But in any case, these stories, they become more than just just a story. More than not even saying that everyone's out there trying to create golems, they create a sense of not only purpose and being, but especially for some Jews in the ghetto who are being constantly attacked, either politically or physically, they are a method of protection. So the stereotypical golem story, or not stereotypical, but really the perfect crystallization of how the golem came to be understood as it happens today, theoretically takes place in the year 1580. Now, the story revolves around a rabbi by the name of Judah Lowell ben Bezalel. He is a real person. He is a very central, important scholar. And so he actually has a title that is just Maharal, which is what I'm going to use. And the title is just an acronym, basically, that shortens the phrase Moren HaRav Lo, or our teacher Rabbi Lo. So, and then that's Maharal. Now, he is one of the most well-known Jewish scholars of all time, which means he is a great candidate for the role of the defender of the downtrodden who uses secret mysticism in order to protect the people. Another element that plays a part in this story that's very important, although often overlooked, is that as far as researchers can tell, the Maharal was an autodidact or a self-taught individual. Now, the legend goes, in 1580 in Prague, there was trouble brewing. As you might imagine, anti-Semitism was fairly common throughout the Middle Ages, unfortunately to today, it would seem. But the newest plot against the people of Israel in Prague was a resurgence of another motif that had just hounded them throughout time. There were rumblings regarding a Catholic priest in the city, whose name was Tadush, who hated the Jews more than anything else. And he had planned to sling against the peaceful Jewish people the most notorious and disgusting of anti-Judaic lies, which is that of blood libel. Now, blood libel has been utilized as a tactic against peaceful Jewish communities since at least the first century AD. The basic premise is that the Jews, in their highly ritualized acts of worship, either frequently or infrequently use the blood of non-Jews in their ceremonies. So, you have the earliest written account of it, which is from an author named Appian, who was a Greco-Egyptian. Now, the people of Israel were almost always under suspicion by the other civilizations they came in contact with, pretty much all of whom would have been polytheists, and because of the Torah, would have been ritually unclean and unable to be fraternized with by the Jews. So,
but if you're new to a town, you basically have to interact with the locals. It sounds like their separation is also due to their culture.
It is a cultural thing. And really what it comes down to is that if you look at the law codes, this was never supposed to be a people that was in the midst of other people. This was supposed to be a people who had Jerusalem and the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel that was their land. They were supposed to stay there and they were supposed to get what they were promised. And so it was supposed to be a very easy thing for them to keep this separation. But then that's why you see throughout the diaspora, you see these Jewish communities, these Jewish quarters, or because they were so disenfranchised and poor and abused in areas, the ghettos, you see them pop up because, okay, well now we're in the midst of the other places, but we still have to remain our community, our own little people. And it is. It's what led to so many different conspiracies coming up against them. You have in Roman culture, the veneration of the imperial cult of Caesar was a must. If you were part of the Roman Empire, you not only had to pay taxes to Caesar, you had to worship Caesar as a god. It was important. It was essential. And yet, the Jews were the only people who were granted an exemption because they would not. Because they were strictly monolatrous people. And so it's really interesting to see that even from, again, our earliest written record is the first century AD, it's almost certainly going back beyond that, just these ideas that, oh, they're different than us. There must be something wrong about them. There must be something fishy. And it's that same old xenophobia that we see even today.
I would think that, like, oh, why don't they want to talk to me? And that leads to that separation.
That does lead to the separation.
That feeling of tribalism.
Yeah, yeah, it is very tribalistic. But this feeling of separation, this tribalism, it led to this idea of blood libel. Now, Appian, again in the first century, he claimed he had it on very good authority that the Jews every year would sacrifice a Greek, and that the leaders of the Jewish community, the priests, would then eat his body and swear eternal hatred against the Greeks.
Ah.
Yes, this is incorrect on a whole lot of accounts, all of the accounts, but it's worth noting some of the big ones as to why this could not be true. Firstly, the Torah forbids the sacrifice of human beings. Secondly, in order to keep kosher, one must abstain from eating any blood whatsoever. Also, to make sure that they remained ritually clean, the priests, for whom it was the most important, they had to be ritually clean, were not even allowed to be in the same room as a dead body, as a dead human body.
I'm sure cannibalism is probably not great either, right?
No, absolutely not. One of the things that makes Yahweh stand out against other nationalistic gods is that he doesn't require human sacrifice. You see a lot of polemics in the Tanakh of pointing to other nations and saying, these are the people who burn their children as offerings to gods. These are the people who kill themselves and each other, who cut themselves and let their blood flow freely as offerings to gods. And that's not how we do things here. And so this idea,
death was a little bit more part of life at that point in time.
Well, that is true. Now, as these rumors of blood libel start kind of gathering steam through the first 1,000 years of the Common Era, what you see, though, is that in the Crusades, the first crusade of the Holy Land in the 11th century, blood libel resurfaces into an even more horrific idea. See, what the Christians would do is they would march through the Holy Land and they would force Jews to convert to Christianity. There was no alternative. If they declined, they would typically be tortured to death, giving them the chance all the way to just convert.
Good old Crusades.
Yep, and you'll be fine. But because of this, there were mass suicides of Jewish communities who were in the path of the Crusaders. They knew what was going to happen, and so instead of letting their children be tortured to death, they killed themselves and killed their children, and they all died together, quickly and mercifully. This led to stories, distortions, from people coming back from the Crusades, Crusaders, Christians, who said that the Jews were the kind of people who could and would murder children without a second thought. And if they did it to their own children, why not do it to Christian children as well? So,
What happens when you get to be the storyteller?
Yeah, I know. So the rumor is that Jews killed Gentiles, and as they come back from the Crusades, that rumor changes to Jews killed Christian children for the use of their customs. The most common charge was that the Jews used the blood of Christian children on the eve of Passover to create wine and matzo bread. Other lies include that around Easter, which of course is always within a few weeks of Passover, Jews would kidnap children to crucify them and to make a mockery of Jesus. There is a whole lot more to this, but that's about all the time we have here on this brief episode of A Brief History of Antisemitism. There are over 150 recorded accounts of blood libel being used throughout the year as a justification for the mass murder or deportation of Jews throughout the world and history. And this is not some old world, terribly backwards idea that we've moved past. Blood libel has been documented as being invoked since at least 2014, and most likely much, 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 much more recently than that as well. This is what Tadush had been planning to unleash against the good people of Prague. Thankfully, when the Maharal caught wind of it, he realized that he had enough time to stop it, and he needed a plan, because this wasn't just talk. Blood libel is behind a number of murders of Jews, official state-sponsored pogroms, and is even one of the main contributing factors that led to Jews being expelled from England in 1290 for almost 400 years. So the Maharal prayed fervently in order to learn how to avert this disaster, which would surely leave many of his people in suffering or even death. And he received an answer from above in a vision and a dream. The answer was Ata Bra Golem Devuk Hakomer Vetegazar Zedim Shavel Torfe Yisroel. So I probably butchered all of that, but essentially it's an alphabetical phrase in the Hebrew which translates to create a golem of clay and by it defend the people of Israel. So using the Kabbalah, the Maharal was able to extract the magical formula from the received words that could be used in order to carry out the creation. He did this by partnering with his son-in-law and his pupil. Now, the lengthiest part of the creation was the purification process, as the three men who would be handling the golem would actually be using a material much more potent than any other magical or mystical force on earth, which was the Shem HaMeforesh, which is the true name of God. This was only known to a small number of the most holy men throughout the generations and was a source of true supernatural power. If even the smallest bit of impurity remained within the users of the name of the Shem, they would cease to exist. God would stop creating them. There's a really cool concept that we can wave as we see by, which is that all of creation is constantly generated. It's not a one-time act. It is constantly being created. But we're just going to wave on that, on our path out of the Middle Ages. Goodbye.
Now, I mean, it makes sense. If you get cut, your body regenerates.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone has to be doing that creating, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, utilizing the hidden cipher provided to the Maharal in his dream, combined with the Shem and the Sever Yitzria, the three men finally got to work, and they shaped the golem out of the clay of the river Maldau, forming it to be lying on its back, facing heaven, and spanning 9 feet. The men were sure to not put too much detail or perfection into the forming of the golem, as it would be a blasphemy to even try to make something perfect, like God alone was able to do. The first participant, the son-in-law, was descended from the ancient order of priests, or Kohen, and he walked around the body counterclockwise 7 times, reciting Kabbalistic incantations. As he did, the clay began to glow red. Then, the Maharal's pupil, who was descended from the tribe of the Levites, which were connected to temple worship, he walked around the being clockwise 7 times, reciting the same incantations. As he did, the golem began to grow hair and nails and ceased to glow red. Finally, the Maharal himself walked around the golem, meditating through the 231 gates of creation and the true name of God, then placing the Shem in the mouth of the golem. After this, all three of the men knelt at its feet and recited aloud the same phrase that in the Hebrew Bible marked the transition of Adam from clay to man, which is, quote, "And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul," unquote. The golem opened his eyes and stood up. They named him Yosel, or Yosef, or Joseph, and he began his work immediately.
Now, that seems like the most intricate summoning of a golem?
Yeah.
Creation of a golem?
It's basically all of them. It's basically everything. There's even another variation wherein he does actually also write on the forehead the Amet and the Met. So it's basically all of them.
Now, has the different ways of creating a golem derived from taking bits and pieces of this story? Or do you think it's the other way around, where how you create a golem is what influenced every act that they did in the creation of this one?
This story, I would say, is the pinnacle of golem stories. It is the culmination of at least 1,800 years of tradition. It's the final product. It doesn't...
So this is the big one.
Yeah, other stories don't take from this story. This story takes from the other stories.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So he begins his work. He's patrolling the streets of the ghetto at night. He's 9 foot tall and he's ready to rumble.
How does that not just terrify the people?
It does, but okay. In a good way. You look at something, it happens to me sometimes when I think about atomic bombs.
So it just seems like the physical representation of Big Brother.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but again, he's bound, right? He obeys you. You don't obey him. That's supposed to be the power dynamic there. Now, Yosef, he did not use violence to accomplish his goal unless he had to, right? So like I said a bit ago, golem were not warriors. They were defenders. They did not go out harassing people. They only stood at the gate to make sure nobody came in. And Yosef did a very good job, and he stopped the blood libel from taking place. He stopped any sort of backlash or pogrom that might have come out of it. But, as we mentioned before, the golem is subject to the laws of God, one of the most important, one of the Ten Commandments, being keep the Sabbath day holy. And every Friday, before the beginning of Shabbat, the Maharal would remove the shem from the mouth of the golem and then replace it. However, one tragic Friday afternoon, the house of the Maharal was struck with tragedy as his young son passed away suddenly from either illness or an accident. It's not really sure which. In his grief, the rabbi neglected to deanimate Joseph, who, pressed to the edges of his abilities, began to go mad. He stopped following the order of the rabbi to simply defend the Jewish people and instead began to attack their Gentile neighbors. The people demanded that the golem be destroyed, with cries even coming from the Holy Roman Emperor, Rudolf II, which is another little aspect here. You actually do see the Maharal does actually meet with the Holy Roman Emperor at a certain point in his life, but they most likely were not discussing golem. Now, the rabbi was all too glad to comply, and after a little bit of trouble, removed the shem from the golem's mouth one last time. Now, the body of the servant of the golem was taken to the Old New Synagogue in Prague, where it remains in the attic to this day, waiting for reanimation if needs be. Like I said, this is the culmination of golem legend, and up until the 19th century, it was what is known to folklorists as an eco-typified legend, which is one that occurs anywhere, at any time, often being said to take place, you know, not too far from here, just down the road in Meridian. There was a man who lived who did this sort of a thing. For everyone who doesn't live in Boise, Meridian's about 13 minutes away. So, however, this story starts getting published in journals and in compendiums of folklore and all of that in the mid-18th century.
Right. You have the printing press. You have ways to spread stories now.
Yeah. And as it is published, it is continually and repeatedly studied or published under the name of the Maharal doing this and in Prague in 1580 AD. So right. This story that belonged to everybody and everywhere became not just a folk legend, but a specific a story of a specific time and place.
So what happens when a golem's master dies before the golem is destroyed?
Well, because the golem can be destroyed by anybody, except in those very specific places where you have to do the 231 gates of meditation, if you're just removing the E or you're removing the shem from the mouth, anybody can do that. I didn't find any of those stories. Okay. I'd assume that most people would probably just get wrecked.
And it's generally in those stories that the creator is the one that ultimately dismisses the creation, right?
Almost always, yeah. Yeah, so, and it's because, especially in like this story, this archetypal story, it's because other people don't know how to do it. Now that I've told all of our listeners, they could stop a golem if they tried hard enough. Even with the 231 gates, I believe in you. You can do this, if needs be. But for the people of Prague, there was just this clay man running around killing people. What are we supposed to do? They didn't know about the name and the mouth and all of that. But yeah, it is typically always the master who destroys it or uncreates it. However, Rabbi Loh, the Maharal, while he definitely studied mysticism, there's nothing in his work to indicate that he had a mastery in the practice of Kabbalah. There's nothing in his memoirs or in the biographies that have been written about him that mention a golem or anything like this. And so again, it's very akin to what we can even see happen sometimes in American history, which is where we take are venerated as close to saints as we have, which is like the founding fathers, and we ascribe all of these almost supernatural elements to them, like George Washington being physically unable to tell a lie about the cherry tree sort of a thing. It's like, okay, so you have a really nice story, and then we're going to go ahead and take that and append it to a very good man or a spiritual giant, as it were. Now, the story of the Golem of Prague, plays a very large part in Jewish folklore around the world to this day, but especially in Czech legend and the folklore of Prague, which has adopted the golem as a kind of mascot, with a lot of local venues using it in some way or the other, or like there'll be like a golem special at the cafe sort of a thing. But the story of the golem really blew up in the beginning and middle of the 19th century. Like I mentioned, you had your prototypical stories that happened, and the first one that we know of is from a pre-children's tale Grimm work. So before the fairy tales Grimm, as we know them, came to be, Jacob Grimm, he brought the tale of the golem out of the Talmudic and Kabbalistic literature and into the view of everyday life. He published it in 1808 and basically just told that archetype of the rabbi who needs some help, gets some help, and then kills the golem because it doesn't rest on the Sabbath. I don't know where he got that story. No one's really, as far as I know, no one's really sure of the source. But 10 years later, Mary Shelley would publish Frankenstein, a story about a created being which increases in power and intelligence as it goes, finally having to be dealt with by its creator. And many literary scholars agree that it was in some way influenced in by this story published by Jacob Grimm. Now, by the middle of the 19th century, the golem stories enjoyed a very wide audience, existing as a unique kind of creature that didn't have its origin in pagan gods or monsters. However, I think it's prudent that as we kind of wrap up here, I want to address one of the things that made the golem so interesting to me, which is Inglourious Basterds.
It always comes back.
It was really when I watched that movie, it kind of reactivated in my head all those years ago. Oh, I've heard that word before. What does that mean? What is a golem? So the question is it probable that Hitler and the German army would have been familiar enough with the golem to be afraid of it? And I would say that it's undeniable. You actually already mentioned it, Jason. There in German cinema, there have been multiple movies about the golem, and almost all of them were what we would think of now as blockbusters. But it always starts in it starts in 1914 when a German language horror fantasy novel called Der Golem, which was written by Gustav Meyrink, was published. The book takes place in Prague and focuses on a jeweler who lives in the ghetto. The golem is a character, but he is more of a shadowy entity than anything else. Basically, he is the conglomeration of the sorrow and misery of the people who live in the ghetto, made manifest and real through their deep emotional pain. Now, the novel did very well. It's been reprinted multiple times, translated into English with a new translation, I want to say as recently as like 2014 or something like that. But the following year, a movie was made by Paul Wegener, who claimed to be basing it off the book, but was most likely just basing it off this legend of the Golem of Prague in general. The movie made two sequels. The first was called The Golem and the Dancing Girl. The second was called The Golem, How He Came Into the World. Now, technically, the first film is called The Golem, but it's been lost, as has the second film. So, the only thing we have remaining is Golem, How He Came Into the World, which is just called Der Golem in German. And that's the movie that we think of. Or not we, but especially people who have seen it, or cinema buffs, think of when they think of the German movie Der Golem. They don't think of the first one, they think of the third one. Now, it was specifically about Rabbi Loh and his creation of the golem, and it definitely wasn't entirely faithful to the legend and the mysticism behind it.
When is a movie adaptation?
I know. Instead of utilizing the divine name, it utilizes an amulet, and instead of utilizing the power of God through creation, it is a demon that comes and basically possesses the clay and kind of plays nice for a minute and then destroys everything. But
it was done by, I'm assuming, a Christian.
Huh.
German?
Probably.
So... Yeah. There's always different interpretations depending on what kind of contents you're looking at. So I wouldn't be surprised if that had some sort of role into it, because at that point in time, anything that is like animated is evil. It's a demon doing it.
Totally.
But it is like post-spiritualism too. So
yeah,
it's an interesting time.
It is. The film has been called a hallmark of German cinema. It's popped up on quite a few like movies to watch before you die lists, even in the modern day.
So in that case, it's pretty safe to assume that most, if not all, of the German soldiers knew of it. This movie.
Yeah, yeah. And the legend as well. Because even if he got the creation wrong and all of that, what did definitely come across was an animated being made by a Jewish sage to defend a Jewish community. And so, if that's your whole game plan, is to target these people, it is almost undeniable to me that probably Hitler himself did not say it. He may have, but his soldiers probably did as well. And in fact, when the SS, when the Gestapo made their way through Prague, they stumbled. Well, so they made their way through Prague.
Sure, they had to go to the synagogue.
Well, the legend is that they tried to, right? There are churches and synagogues that were destroyed in Prague by the Germans. However, the old new synagogue is the oldest synagogue in Prague. It is the oldest active synagogue in all of Europe, being completed in 1270. The fact that it wasn't destroyed by the Nazis is quite remarkable. And so the legend goes that the reason it wasn't destroyed is because a group of Gestapo went in with the intention of burning it down. They go, they make their way to the attic, and what's there? The golem. And although he would have been deactivated, of course, and all of that, he was able to somehow reanimate in that moment because he knew he was needed. He knew he had to defend, and so he did, and he tore these damn Nazis limb from limb and threw them away like chicken bones. And to me, the fact that that story, I don't know if anybody believes it to be true, but the fact that that story is told is beautiful. Like, it's amazing that this legend comes out of this dark time of this ancestral protector coming back. I love it, man. And that's what folklore does for me. Like, that's to me the just amazing. And so to this day, there's like a golem museum you can go to. It's all over Prague, but the golem remains as a figure in the minds of people all throughout the world that says, I am a defender. I'm here to defend a specific people in a specific way of life. And it works also, as we've mentioned a few times now, a very Frankenstein-esque creature, a mankind-created life. What could go wrong? This is what could go wrong. And like I mentioned at the beginning, it's used to talk about not only classic literature and mythology, it's used as a metaphor for AI, for robotics, automatons of all kind.
Yeah, it's a story that just keeps getting a facelift.
Yeah, yeah, and it will continue to. I mean, it's...
Well, until we create something like Skynet and it kills us all.
Well, even then, there might be a story of something rising out of the human world and trying to defend this downtrodden people group, even if their oppressors are the cybernetic overlords. But who knows, man? Jason, what do you think? What do you got? Say something.
I think it's a tale as old as time.
It's a tale as old as time. Man made out of dirt.
Exactly. I think I've kind of spoke about it throughout the entire thing here.
All right. Okay, good.
Throughout the entire episode. Like, you know, it for me, this is, again, kind of a learning experience in a way for man to make up for his own shortcomings in some way. The golem is made in order to make man's life better.
To bridge the gap between what we are and what we would like to be?
Ure. Yeah.
Right?
Like, almost like a personification of what we can't do.
Yeah, because if I had someone to do all of my work for me, I could be whoever I want to be. The only thing I'm lacking is time, right?
Right.
That's what we think. But in reality, I'm just an idiot.
And then you kind of have to come to the realization that what you ask for isn't necessarily the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you get more than what you bargain for. And then you have to come to the realization that your creation is wrong, or it must be put to an end. So it's, again, kind of this life cycle of learning and understanding.
Yeah,
don't make stuff. I And the golem itself seems like just purely a personification of technology.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's now. Yeah, I mean, I remember in like third grade, my teacher once asked us, she was like, what is technology? And we all had all sorts of different little third grade answers. And she said, technology is anything that makes a person's life easier. It's anything that does work for a person.
Right.
And that's exactly, that is. It's like, this is the spirit of that. It's the right. And for it to come, not come out of the mid-1800s, right? Again, we spent a long time covering its legacy. But for it to really become what it is now and to get so popular during that time, I can't help but think like it is. It's because the world really started changing really quite fast. It empowers, technology empowers, but at the same time, technology also destroys, and technology also can and will ruin your life if you let it, you know? And if you get used to it doing all of your work, and then one day it goes wild and dies, even if it's not killing you and you don't have to kill it, but it just dies, then you're not used to doing your work.
Yeah.
And you don't know how.
You grew dependency on it.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is take the phone in your hand and crush it. Crush it and free yourself. Cool.
I don't recommend doing that because then you can't listen to us anymore.
There are ways. I will be on your local street corner this very afternoon. I guarantee it. I don't guarantee that.
But it's a beautiful day out. I wouldn't
it really is quite nice. But you could always just believe that I'll be on your local street corner. And by believing, you will make it so. So.
Just don't go test that belief. Anyway. True. So, Sam.
Yeah.
Clearly, to me, this is a story.
Oh.
Do you think that
there's any real truth
to this? Yeah,
that's a really interesting thing that I didn't bring up.
Contemplate?
No, I definitely have contemplated it. So that's the thing. We know Rabbi Lo, the Maharal, he did not create a golem to defend Prague. We know that. But does that mean there are no golem? I don't know.
Are they almost perfect?
I'm going to say that there are golem.
Are they too perfect for us to tell? Is there
supposed to be weird looking. Like, that's a pretty important component. Well, and so that's the same thing, though. God, we're back. You took us back to it. Battlestar Galactica and Blade Runner. These are all, that's exactly it. If it looks like me and it has approached me in sophistication and intelligence, even though it's created by me, does that make it less than me? This is a question that can't be totally asked and grasped without a story like this. This story is not only the progenitor of like Mary Shelley, which of course is the progenitor of pretty much all modern science fiction, but it's also the direct progenitor of modern science fiction as well. Like, it is. What if they are? What if they walk among us? The Cylons, the Replicants, and the Golem. Who knows, man?
Probably the golems.
They do. They are. They're there. For me, I just really like
golems. They're probably self-aware.
I really like that idea of the 231 gates. I don't know why, but this idea of like reality building through like all those steps, it's very satisfying to me.
Okay.
I
like the idea that it's kind of like man being a child trying to create a clay figure versus an adult who can sculpt David. You know, like it's, I like that idea that we try to imitate what we think of as being a perfect being's capabilities.
But the sculpture of David and the clay figure that I make are both equally alive, which is to say they are not alive at all. Like, it can be the greatest, most wonderful thing, or it can be like the crappiest I made it in 3 minutes thing. And they're both the same type of thing. And that's pretty wild to me. That's pretty wild.
So, do we have any final thoughts on these golems?
I think they're here.
Okay.
Just like the aliens are here, just like the wolfmen are here. No, I don't. I actually
Well,
don't
if they're made
here.
Of the earth, they are all around us.
That's the scariest thing you've said all day.
You're welcome.
They're not scary. They're fine. I love it. I think I always will. No, I think I'm pretty well golemed out.
Perfect.
That's
the way I like to hear it.
I would really like to thank everyone for sticking with me through that. You probably learned a lot of things that you just frankly don't care about. And that's fine. I am grateful for you. Jason, what are you doing next week?
Sam, we're going to be talking about something near and dear to me, which is exploration.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about old maps of places and things.
Or whatever. Is that a guy?
I have no idea.
DeGama?
You just said words to me.
Gama
de Vasco? Who? No.
Francisco de Gama? Whoever. We'll figure it out. Jason's going to do a special. Why is Jason going to do a special? Because he can. Thank you. Secondly, because...
Why are you defending me?
Because your last special was like 3 episodes ago. It was really quite recent. And I didn't realize that until after I asked you to do one. It's because we're only recording every other week now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But then on our 100th episode, which comes a week after Jason, or 2 weeks after Jason's, we're going to cover a topic that is near and dear to my heart.
Oh, no.
Which is our next installment.
Oh, no.
Of conspiracies Jason just doesn't understand. Which is that Stanley Kubrick faked the moon landing.
No!
And we're going into this, and we're not coming out until I am goddamn sure that the moon is fake. Not that the moon landing was fake,
but the moon is itself.
Just get ready. We're going to rehash some old favorites like David Icke's Hollow Matrix or Moon Matrix Theory, and we're going to take a look at some new stuff. So that's coming up in a month. Yeah. I'll buy us some beer. It'll be a great time. Anyway, so that is what is on your Not Alone horizon.
Unless you're also a patron. Because then that's we've got true. Space penguins that's coming true. Up we for do some have silly space reason.
Yep, we're going to research and record that through this week and next
Is it
week.
Because they're already wearing suits.
Oh, now that's a good question.
I have no idea what this means to
I'm not sure, but I love it. So yeah, we're going to be doing that in the next week as well. So if you're interested in that, you can head over to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/notalonepodcast. We did get a few new patrons that I'd like to thank really quick before we let the day get away from us, as it were. So I'd like to thank Jake Twyford.
Woo, Jake!
Brooke Herrenberg. Ehrenberg? Yeah. Herrenberg? Ehrenberg. Brooke Ehrenberg. All
yeah,
right,
Brooke!
We'd like to thank Kelsey Hill.
Woo, Kelsey!
And we'd like to thank Amanda Vaughn.
Amanda!
Guys, thank you all so much for contributing to the Patreon. It really does keep all of our lights on. I'm not going to count them, but there's a lot of them. And right now, it is directly going towards Jason's dream that I only took 100 episodes to get behind, which is for us to do this in video. And so Jason,
we're getting there, folks.
Jason is spending all of his free time building and buying and crafting and dreaming, and soon we'll be on a YouTube near you,
and hopefully a screen as well.
No screens,
just on the YouTube. in the ether of YouTube, that's where we'll be. So yes. Stay tuned,
YouTube. The other people that we'd like to thank are those who left us nice reviews on the iTunes store.
I'd like to thank those of those that left bad reviews, too.
I'm not going to thank those people.
Criticism, as long as it's constructive, is helpful.
Huh. Well, you know...
I won't listen to it,
you know,
but it's helpful.
How often internet commenters give constructive criticism? Not very often.
Well, I've been on the internet, That's true. I'm aware.
So I'd like to thank Dude9577, PBJ T-shirt Guy, and Jeremy English. I'm going to read Jeremy English's. It says, "Remember, we are not drunk alone in history. Thank you, Jeremy. They say, "Not Alone Podcast is a lot of fun, very informative and interesting. For those who are into the strange and the unknown, the show is very similar with that of Astonishing Legends, but has its own style. Not Alone is akin to shows like Drunk History, where the information is there and still very informative of the topics, and at the same time mixed in with hilarious offshoots and side stories. The show has the feel of a group of friends who plan to sit down for a night of board games, D&D. Please don't bring up D&D with me and Jason. We've been trying to play D&D for like a year now. Or video games, but got sidetracked talking about the different spooky and mysterious stories, this is quite a comment, that have happened in the world. The constant sidetracks or nerdy references help to enhance this feel. It helps to make it feel very casual. It is so personable that I catch myself replying to Sam and Jason to elaborate on something I knew and they didn't at the time, which I can totally understand, and I do that all the time. When I'm listening to a podcast and someone says something wrong, I will audibly say no! So I get you. Or joining in on a joke, then I realize they won't reply. The balance of Sam and Jason as believer and skeptic works beautifully to cover the two different sides of the coins with investigation, so if all this sounds good to you, you will enjoy this podcast. Remember, if you are sitting at work with your earbuds in, pretending to work, or sitting in a car in bumper-to-bumper traffic, talking back to a podcast that won't reply when you're done, you are not alone. Woo! That was a heck of a review. I think that might be our longest review.
That's it.
I know. It was really quite good.
Well done. No more reviews.
No more show. We almost canceled the show because we lost our USB-C to USB adapter.
Excuse me.
But I found it.
We?
Yes. Other than that, Jason, do you got anything else?
I've got nothing, Sam.
Okay. You can find me on Twitter at BeerLordElfBane. You can find Jason on Twitter at
MightyMoit.
You can find us on Twitter collectively. Well, not even really, because I run the Twitter account.
Yeah,
at NotAlonePod.
You don't give me access.
You can access. I gave you all of the passwords, Jason.
You don't want me to have access. I've recently broken up with Twitter just so I don't get any Avenger spoilers. So,
oh, that's fair.
Yeah. Because I heard about leaks and stuff, so
I'm
trying to stay away from the internet as much as possible, which has been hard.
I dreamt the ending of Game of Thrones, and because of that, I am no longer afraid of spoilers. Don't, like, at me, though. Don't be that guy and at me in
just
spoilers.
Just don't throw it in his face
but
and ruin
I did
everything.
Have a very specific dream where I was like, I can't watch this. I'm not caught up. I'm not going to understand. This is going to spoil everything for me. And then I watched it, and guess what? I didn't die. I was fine. Life is more than entertainment. Thank you. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast, or join our Facebook group. Remember, we are Not Alone, a community for the strange. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com, or if you have stories you'd like to tell us, as some of you do, I know you do, and you just haven't got around to emailing them yet, that's fine. You can either type them out or record yourself telling me those stories, and then send those to notalonepodstories@gmail.com for inclusion, or for consideration in inclusion in our next listener special, which will be pretty much as soon as we have enough stories to do one. So keep that in mind. You have been warned. Who did it last week?
I did.
Did you? Okay.
We really have to figure this out.
We keep reminding...
The problem is that because of the patron episodes as well.
Yeah, that's true.
It keeps throwing us off.
It is. We don't do it in the patron episodes.
We don't?
So we do the off-Wiedersehen thing.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I don't know what you're talking about.
Take the wheel. You got this.
Remember, whether you find yourself prowling the streets at night, only to be overshadowed by a 9-foot-tall man made of clay with eyes of fire, or you put on a cursed amulet, which somehow negates all of the years of history and tradition that should have gone into making this movie, Wegner, you are not alone.